Justice Holland is suffering from laryngitis, so if there's any talking that has to be done by the court, I'll do it. And for now, I'll just ask, are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Please do.
May it please the court, good afternoon. I represent Mary Sutherland. Mary Sutherland was charged with two counts of vehicular assault and one count of driving under the influence on May the 8th of 2005. On June the 7th, I filed a very detailed discovery request to the state, as I was required to do. I never received any response from the state to that discovery request. It was a detailed point-by-point request, which was not responded to. On the two or three days before the trial was a Wednesday, the trial was the 13th of July of 2005. On that preceding Thursday, I called the state because I didn't have discovery. I didn't have the blood. A prosecutor looked in the file, said, we don't have a blood reading. Call me tomorrow. I called the next day, no blood. I showed up for trial, but before that, on a Tuesday at 3 o'clock, I got an email for the first time advising me that there was a videotape statement from my client which had not been produced. When I appeared for court, I moved to the next morning after waiting probably 2 or 3 hours before they got started, so that my client and I had been there for some period of time. I moved to suppress all of the evidence. The record is pretty clear that the court's position was not ever that there should be some sanction for the state, but rather suggestions of what I could do differently. And actually, the court made the comment that in this court, it sometimes happens that in these kinds of cases we get discovery on the morning of trial, and then added, you try a lot of these, maybe too many of these, and the only inference I could gather from that was perhaps I didn't need the amount of preparation time that that somebody else who doesn't do too many of those may need. My position is threefold in this case. One is that it was a clear discovery violation by not giving me the documents and asking me to be the one sanctioned rather than the state. Secondly, that court conceded that it was an improper detention and an illegal arrest, and even after concluding it was an illegal arrest, continued to allow all of the evidence to come in. And then finally, which includes the Miranda issue, which is my third, what I would say, significant argument, and that is that after it was agreed that the Harrington officer had arrested Mary, clearly she was in custody, couldn't leave. We had a debate about whether it was a 1902 detention or whether it was an arrest. The court concluded that it was an arrest, albeit an illegal one. The court then allowed the state trooper, without Mirandizing Mary, to question her. That the Superior Court agreed that that was improper, but arguing the U.S. Supreme Court Oregon Ebers as opposed to Missouri Siebert said it was cured by the later Miranda warnings. My argument to you is that it wasn't, because when the state trooper arrived at the scene and ultimately back at the station Mirandized Mary, he simply said to her, anything you say now will be used against you, your normal Miranda warnings, but never did anything to allow her to understand that he could not use the statements that were non-Mirandized, in which he both admitted being the driver and to drinking. The original officer, Sayers, from Harrington, admitted at the time that he took her into custody, placed her in the car, he did not even know if she was the driver when the accident had happened, whether she consumed alcohol afterwards, because he testified there was alcohol found in the car, and simply took the position that we get discovery on these cases on the morning of trial. His words were sometimes, and the matters should proceed. My position is that it clearly was a violation of the discovery rules. They're there for a reason. This court has held on a number of occasions that the defense puts out a point-by-point discovery request. It should be responded to in a point-by-point fashion. None of that was done here.
Well, does a violation of the discovery rules automatically mean that your client goes free?
No, I didn't suggest that, Your Honor. I simply suggested that they suppress the evidence that was not produced. They could have tried the cases and...
That would be a possible sanction. Is that the only thing that the trial court's allowed to do when there's a discovery violation?
They have other options under the rule, Your Honor, but I don't know I don't know that any of the options are to sanction the defense rather than the state, and that's what happened here.
In what way?
The state said the court said you can have a continuance.
Why is that a sanction?
As I told the judge on the record that day, I'd come down from Newcastle County. I said my client, who'd taken the day off, we'd been there for a number of hours before they finally called the case, and as I clearly indicated to the trial judge, my lady's job was very dependent on whether or not she was going to be able to get this thing resolved in a prompt fashion. She works as a nurse for the Alfred Idipon Institute Hospital, and she and her promotion and job was dependent on a rapid resolution of the matter. So there was detriment flowing to her. She and I did everything that we possibly could have done for me to be as prepared as I can. This court, particularly this court, requires that anybody that practices in this court be as prepared and do as thorough a job as they can, and that's what I tried to do. I did everything the rule required me to do. The state did nothing the rule required them to do.
Let me interrupt you there, Mr. Ferrara. There is an argument in the state's brief that because the prosecutor did notify you the day before the trial that there was a videotape, that you did have a window of time, although a narrow one, to look at the videotape before the trial.
Actually, Your Honor, if you mean I could have seen it the night before, I could not have, because I got the email from her. She sent it at 3, and I don't think I saw it right at 3. I think I saw it some later time. But of course, she has the video in Dover, and I'm in Wilmington, and she just simply said, we have it. In fact, she mistakenly, I don't think she certainly didn't do this deliberately, she represented it as an in-car video. In-car videos are a little different than what it actually turned out to be. An in-car video simply would have been a recordation on tape of the field coordination tests, which at least I had a written results for. It turned out that's not what it was. It was an in-station, basically confession from my client. So that was not a practical solution at that point. In fact, at the time that I questioned the trooper Rendon about it, what I learned was that he had actually told the state that he'd had the tape for a couple of weeks. My discovery letter is pretty specific. It says, don't just look in your own file. I appreciate that other people may have things. My letter says, look in the files of the arresting police officer agency to see if they have any discoverable material, and clearly that didn't happen here.
So your position is that by not excluding the tape and offering only a postponement of the trial, and that the trial judge abused his discretion.
I do, Your Honor. If this had been a situation, I think the situation could have been somewhat different if the court had said to the state, give me your explanation for this, which they never did. If you look at the transcript, that's on pages 7 and 8 of the transcript, the minute I mention the discovery violation, there's never any indication that the state, why didn't you comply, you have to do this, you have to do that. The judge simply said, in these cases, we sometimes get discovery on the morning of trial. You've tried too many of these cases. Many of these may be too many. The implication I drew from that is you can do it on the fly. That's not fair to the client. The other problem with this case is it wasn't simply a DUI. I appreciate that perhaps if it had been a speeding violation and they're giving me radar logs on the morning of trial, that would have been one thing. These were two criminal charges for which he ultimately was jailed. This court requires better performance by the state than that. The court makes the comment that the state was somewhat lackadaisical in its response, and with all due respect, I suggest that was somewhat of an understatement. They made no response. And to have my client come down, wait for a number of hours to get started, be in the situation where she knew she had to resolve it quickly because of her job. And I mentioned that. This is not something I'm telling you now. That was all on the record before the trial judge. And the judge simply suggested, you know, you can look at it right now and we can proceed. I don't believe that I am complying with what this court wants me to do in fairly and thoroughly representing the clients. I did everything I was supposed to do. Quite frankly, they did nothing that they were supposed to do. And in fact, the trial judge asked the state, have you reviewed the tape? What's on it? They didn't know because they hadn't looked at it themselves at that point. The tape turned out to be extremely damaging because what happened was I ultimately got, and I think this is fair for the court to consider, I tried to suppress the blood because they didn't give it to me in time. They actually handed me the blood result in the middle of the trial. And that's the first time I saw the blood result. The court said
that evidence was excluded because the flea bite.
It was, and that's the point I want to make. The court said that's too extreme a remedy, yet when they didn't identify the phlebotomist, the court thought it was an appropriate remedy. I suggest that it was an appropriate remedy throughout. The tape was extremely damaging and because it filled in the gaps that Shires didn't have, which is, were you the driver? Did you consume alcohol after the fact? So I think there are really a lot of issues here, not the least of which is the court concludes it was an illegal arrest. If it's an illegal arrest, then everything that flows from the illegal arrest should have been suppressed. So what you have is the officer putting her in the car, conceding that he doesn't know if she's the driver, doesn't know if she drank afterwards, and advising her that she was not, I'm not sure he advised her by verbally, but by his actions, that she was not free to leave. Clearly, if she wasn't free to leave, she was arrested. The judge below didn't ask the state what their position was. He started to take the position that she was actually detained, and I pointed out that there was no compliance with 1902, and then he said, well, it was at least a detention and actually concluded that it was an illegal arrest. If it's an illegal arrest, everything stops there. So either it should have been suppressed because they didn't comply with discovery, or it should have been suppressed because once he concluded it was an illegal arrest, they shouldn't have been able to use any of that information. But what ended up happening was, after she was clearly arrested, when I objected to the non-Mirandized questioning, the court offered no explanation, simply said overruled. And if you looked at the Superior Court opinion, you'll see that those statements should not have come in. If those statements don't come in, or if she had been properly warned on those statements in the Miranda tape, maybe she doesn't make the statement. It's hard to know the answer to that question because it never happened. But under Siebert,
let me interrupt for a minute because I'm a little bit confused. The trial court said that this was an illegal arrest?
They did.
Which trial court?
The Common Pleas trial judge.
Said that it was an illegal arrest.
Well, it says a lot of things, but if you look at page, do you have the transcript? I don't know whether you do, but if you look at I want to say page 7. No, I'm sorry. I think it's page 41. At page 41, the court says, I agree. It appears that at least detained and improperly. If I use the word illegally, I apologize. He said improperly arrested. Do you find that?
Right.
If she's improperly arrested, everything that flows from the arrest should have been suppressed. At this point, when she's in the car, Your Honor, the state trooper Rendon hasn't arrived yet. All we have is the Harrington police officer testifying that he arrived at the scene, didn't know if this was the car that was involved, didn't know if this lady was the driver, didn't know if she consumed alcohol afterwards, had no admissions from her. The only question he asked her was what happened, and she said, I don't know, which interestingly was the same response of the two people that were in the other car. Nobody seemed to know what happened. It was one of those impacts that I guess surprised everybody. So my position is either it gets suppressed because the arrest is illegal, but certainly it should get suppressed because there was no compliance with the discovery. This court's been pretty clear, going back most significantly to the Johnson versus the State case almost 20 years ago, that discovery, there's a rule for it, there's a meaningful response required, and in protecting the defendants, discovery needs to be complied with. It can't be I strongly disagree with the court approving the idea that sometimes we get discovery on the morning of trial. That doesn't ever happen in the Superior Court in Newcastle County, and it doesn't ever happen in the Court of Common Pleas in Newcastle County. If discovery isn't complied with well in advance, that evidence is suppressed. And I suggest that's what should have happened here. Or at least there should have been some indication that the state needed to do something, not me getting tagged with a continuance on a client who had been in jeopardy for some period of time, whose job was in jeopardy as we sat there.
Apart from the discovery argument that you've just made, you also argue that the Miranda warning or absence thereof is a separate ground for suppressing the tape. Is that correct?
I do.
I'm a little confused, actually, by a comment that you made earlier in your oral presentation about what the argument is. I thought the argument was that because the initial questioning was not preceded by a Miranda warning, even though there had been an arrest, that somehow tainted the statement that was made after there was an actual Miranda warning.
In
your comment, you also suggested that the contents of the Miranda warning that was actually given were somehow not adequate. Did I hear you right?
Well, only in the sense, yes, in this sense. There are two Supreme Court of the United States decisions. There's the Oregon case of I want to say, 95, and the Siebert, Missouri case, which is 10 years later. I think there's a couple times in there where both the state and I have different dates on those, but they're approximately 10 years apart, whatever they are, Siebert being a more recent case. In Siebert, there's some guidelines. The only case in Delaware that I know about is the Madison case, M-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, that Judge Scott decided in Superior Court when he suppressed. What I'm saying is that after he got the statements, were you the driver, were you drinking, that type of information without Mirandizing her, he then takes her back and clearly does Mirandize her back at the station. No question about that. What I'm saying is where it fails under the Supreme Court Siebert, as I read Siebert, Missouri, is he didn't let her know that not only what I want to ask you now that I've Mirandized you can and will be used against you, but your earlier statements can't be used because they were not the product of Miranda.
Mr. Farrar, the time has not been set correctly, so you are actually now into your rebuttal time, and I just wanted to warn you of that.
Thank you. Unless you have any other questions, then I'm going to sit down. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs. May it please the Court. I'll try to address the two issues that I believe have been touched upon here. It looks like it's arguments 2 and 4 in the opening brief. But if there's questions the Court has on any of the other arguments, I'll certainly attempt to respond to those. Turning first to the discovery argument, which has been the major focus in the arguments this afternoon, what happened here was there was a defense discovery request that was dated June the 7th of 2005. On June the 8th, the state, apparently not in response to the discovery request, but simply as a matter of course, had already forwarded the alcohol influence report, the crime report. There were also, in addition to the DUI charge, there were two charges of second-degree vehicular assault and the Court of Common Pleas information. So this is not a case where no discovery was submitted by the state. Some discovery had been sent as early as June the 8th in this particular case. What the prosecutrix did not realize, and her explanation was because there was no indication in the police report, was that there was a videotape interview that was done at the state police troop of Mary Sutherland after the collision. When she found out about this videotape the day before the trial, she did fax a notification to defense counsel, and that was what engendered the discovery complaint on the day of trial. The court did afford defense counsel the opportunity for either a continuance or just an opportunity to review the tape itself. Defense counsel declined both of those opportunities as offered by the court in this case. And I think the court's ruling correctly characterizes what is at issue here. It's not a total failure of discovery, but simply a delayed discovery response.
Could I interrupt you for a moment with respect to the notification that the videotape had been found, or yes, that there was a videotape? Was that in response to the defense request, or was that notification given sua sponte?
I guess it depends on how you look at it. It looks like things crossed in the mail on June 7th and 8th, so I don't know if it was technically in response to a discovery request, but it certainly could be viewed that way or could be viewed the other way. I don't know that the prosecutrix said in the facts, this is in response to your earlier discovery request, but once the state was aware that there was a videotape, defense counsel was notified. The following morning at trial, the trial judge offered defense counsel the opportunity either for a continuance of the trial that date or simply to adjourn and allow defense counsel to view the videotape before the trial proceeded. Defense counsel declined both of those options and proceeded on to trial. Under the Court of Common Pleas criminal rule, which is similar to Superior Court rule, there's four potential sanctions that can be imposed by a trial judge. They can grant a continuance of the matter. They can order production of discovery if no discovery has yet been submitted. Or they can restrict the use of evidence or suppress evidence, or I think the fourth category is any other order that the court deems appropriate. In this particular case, since the disputed discovery, the videotape had already been made available, it was not a case that the court had to order production, that it was already out there and made known and made available to defense counsel to view if he so chose. What the trial judge did was utilized both the first and second options and said, well, you can have a continuance if you want. The prosecutrix said that the state certainly had no problem if the defense wanted a continuance on the day of trial. That was fine with the state. So I think the judge properly exercised his discretion in this case. It's not a situation where no sanction was imposed whatsoever. There was certainly the possibility of either a continuance or simply an adjournment for sufficient time to view the videotape. So I think the trial judge acted appropriately and responsibly in this situation. The other half of the motion to suppress dealt with the blood report, and in that case, the trial judge did suppress that. The distinction the trial judge made was, well, the phlebotomist isn't here. She can't be cross-examined by defense counsel. There's obviously going to be some prejudice or detriment to the defense if this witness is not here on the day of trial. So for that reason, the trial judge, again, in the exercise of his discretion, suppressed the blood evidence, and there was no actual BAC reading on the basis of the blood in this particular case.
Was there also a motion to suppress the statement on the basis of the Miranda problem?
Yes.
Was that raised?
I think that was raised during the trial, as I recall, that there was some testimony. I think Officer Shires, who was the first officer on the scene, he was actually a Harrington police officer, and he was notified by KentCom that there had been a hit-and-run accident and that a white Mercury was allegedly involved and may have fled the scene. He happened to get there first before the Delaware State Police trooper. This was outside the city limits of Harrington, so he really didn't have a lawful authority to arrest anybody, but he was the first officer on the scene. And what happened was, I think Officer Shires testified, and then at that point defense counsel said, this may be an appropriate time to address the probable cause issue, which was the basis for the suppression, that there wasn't probable cause to take her into custody. What happened was when
I was asking about the Miranda warnings. Right. And the absence of Miranda warnings.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I think what happened was Officer Shires did not administer Miranda.
Right.
And that was the basis, as well as not having probable cause to remove her from her vehicle and place her in the police car. When Trooper Rindon arrived at the scene thereafter, she was already in the back seat of the Harrington police car. He did not Mirandize her immediately. She was taken, I believe, from the scene where her car was stopped approximately a half mile, three quarters mile north of the collision scene on U.S. Route 13. She was, I think, taken first to the collision scene and from there was taken, I believe, to Milford Hospital where the blood was drawn. And after that was taken to the troop where the videotape interview was done. And it was at the troop where the Miranda warnings were actually given. So the suppression issue related to all of her statements prior to the videotape and the Miranda. At that time, there was also a contention that because the police officer had obtained pre-Miranda statements from the accused, that should also result in suppression of statements made even post-Miranda. And what the trial judge did, and the Superior Court judge disagreed, was he allowed the evidence in. The Superior Court judge said, well, I disagree with a portion of the trial judge's ruling. I think that the pre-Miranda statements of the accused should have been suppressed. However, since the post-Miranda statements are virtually the same as I think the way the Superior Court judge characterized them, that any error in allowing these other earlier statements in, this was a non-jury trial, was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because it was simply cumulative evidence. The trial judge did address the two U.S. Supreme Court decisions that have been referred to here today, the Oregon versus Elstead case and the Missouri Siebert case, and the Superior Court judge did not find that this was an impermissible police tactic, which is what these cases are aimed at, where the police will try to elicit a confession from somebody without administering the Miranda warnings. Once they've got the confession, then they will go ahead and Mirandize the suspect and try to elicit the same information post-Miranda.
Well, let me ask you a little bit about that. Does it have to be that bad, if you will, before the post-Miranda confession is thrown out? I understand that there's a finding, and it seems perfectly appropriate, given the record, that this was not a police practice, so to speak, that this was not a way of doing business where they bring people into the police station and start asking them questions, get them to confess, and then say, oh, by the way, let me give you your Miranda warnings and get them to confess a second time. That's kind of your easy case. And at the other end of the spectrum, you've got a situation where somebody just starts talking and you know, wasn't even in custody and arguably there was no need to give Miranda warnings anyhow, and then Miranda warnings may be given later. This is somewhere in between, isn't it?
I think it would be, yes, on that kind of continuum. It's not entirely spontaneous utterances by the accused, not in response to the interrogation.
There were specific questions being asked in the police car, right?
Correct. Yes, I think that's all true.
And although, as I understand it, the police officer said that he didn't really think that she was under arrest at that point, the trial court ultimately found, or the Superior Court ultimately found, that she was under arrest, right?
Correct, yes.
And wouldn't it be fair to say that a police officer ought to have some appreciation of the idea that when you've got a potential suspect in your police car, that they don't really feel free to just walk away?
Oh, I think so. And I think that kind of gets back to the first issue that was raised on appeal about the probable cause. And then what you have to look at then is, well, what did the officer know before he removed Mary Sutherland from her car?
No, I'm still interested only in the statements, okay, not the probable cause. And there were questions asked when she was in the police car that she gave incriminating answers to, right?
Yes.
And that was before she got any Miranda warnings. And the Superior Court ultimately found that the information that she provided, those statements, should not have been admitted because she was in custody and hadn't been given Miranda warnings. So the question, as I understand it, what's left is what about what she said after she was given Miranda warnings, right?
That's correct.
But at that point, she didn't realize that she could just be quiet and they wouldn't be able to use the first things that she had said, right? In other words, if a person confesses and says, yes, I was drunk, I was driving, I was in an accident, and I left the scene of an accident. And then they say, oh, by the way, let me give you some Miranda warnings. You don't have to speak to us, and so on and so forth. At that point, how would a person understand that what you've just told the police, they can't use that? So if you keep your mouth shut now, they can't make use of your earlier confession.
Well, I don't know if a person would discern that or not. What they are told with Miranda, though, is that if they say anything further, that anything they say can and will be used against them. So she was certainly advised of that. And what the Superior Court judge found was that after being affirmatively advised of that, what the accused said, the quote was, contained virtually the same admissions that she had made before. And that's why the Superior Court judge found it harmless. He also pointed to the factor that's addressed in the Supreme Court U.S. Supreme Court precedents about whether there's a break in interrogation or not, and that's viewed, I think, as a significant factor, because if there's been a break between initial improper or un-Mirandized or unwarned interrogation and subsequent post-Mirandized interrogation, that's a significant factor for the courts to look at. Superior Court judge noted that.
But isn't it the case that from the time she was put in the police car, she was basically taken from one place to the next and not... There was not a break in terms of she went home and she came back the next day kind of thing, right?
Oh, yeah. No, I think what they're meaning is there a break in interrogation? You know?
So even if she's in custody for the whole time, let's give a different fact pattern. She's in the police station in an interrogation room and questions are asked and then the police leave and somebody brings her lunch and they come back 3 hours later and give her Miranda warnings and start questioning her again. There's been a break in terms of time, but all that time she's been in custody. Does that matter that she's been in custody? In other words, is a break in time all that's necessary?
No, I don't know that that's all that's necessary, but I think it's a totality of circumstances test. It's one of the circumstances.
What else would be necessary? What else would be necessary?
I guess an opportunity to consult with counsel if the individual wanted to do that, or an opportunity
not,
to make
not
a
available
phone call.
Here.
No, not available here.
She wasn't even told she had the right to consult with counsel.
No, not initially. Not before the Miranda, no.
Right. And it's been argued to us that when the Miranda warning was finally given, one thing that the defendant was not told was that everything that she had told the police before, that is the incriminating statements that she'd made before, could not be used against her. She didn't know that.
No, she didn't. That's correct. That's
And had she known that, can we not assume that she might have hesitated before giving the same statements, this time post-Miranda?
Well, I don't know. That's speculation if she would or she wouldn't. She made incriminating statements after being given her Miranda rights, being told that anything she said couldn't would be used against her. And she went ahead and made statements after being given that explicit warning. So I don't know that, you know, assuming that she would not have said anything.
Well, we don't know that she would or would not have had she known that her prior statements.
No, and then I think you're, excuse me, go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Then I think you're back to the factors the U.S. Supreme Court talks about. And one of those that the Superior Court at least addressed was, is there a break in time between un-Mirandized interrogation and subsequent post-Mirandized interrogation? And the Superior Court thought that that was a significant factor here. And that was the basis for finding harmless error in this particular instance. In this case, what are we really talking about suppressing? Well, there were, I guess, a couple of things that she did say that were incriminating. She admitted being the driver. However, when Patrolman Shires got there, she's the only person in the car. The front end is obviously damaged. It's within sight of the accident scene, and the airbags have been deployed, and she doesn't know what she hit in the middle of the road. She volunteers that statement while she's still in her own car. So I don't know that her admitting that she's the driver adds a great deal. It's certainly more direct evidence, but there was circumstantial evidence that she was the only person there. In terms of whether or not she had consumed any alcohol afterwards, that was admitted in the post-Mirandized statements. However, the police officer testified that her speech was slurred, that he detected a strong odor of alcohol about her person while she's still in her car. And most importantly, he observes beer cans on the passenger floorboard in the vehicle that Mary Sutherland was driving. So
do you know if how much time had elapsed between the accident and the time that the police first approached her vehicle?
No, I don't know that. One of the problems we had was that the state had was that the only apparent eyewitness was not available for trial. The two people in the lead vehicle that were struck, they never knew what struck them from the rear. All they realized was that suddenly their vehicle was going off the road and it ended up in a ditch, and they apparently lost consciousness for a while. There was an individual who stopped and approached the driver of the vehicle that was struck, and he was carrying the white bumper from the Mercury and said he had seen the accident, but he wasn't available as a witness for trial. So we don't have a specific time. Apparently, though, 911, the KentCom Center, was alerted sometime within the accident time frame there, and Officer Shires was the first officer to respond. And he was given some information that there was a possible hit and run and that the alleged fleeing vehicle was white Mercury. So, well, someone had supplied that.
Right. No, what I'm trying to get at is the question of how significant it is that she admitted to having been drinking when the police officer had independent information that suggested that she was drinking based upon her behavior and the smell of alcohol and that sort of thing. If we're not talking about a matter of minutes later, then you can't necessarily draw the connection without her admission that she had been drinking before the accident. So that's why I'm trying to pin down in terms of what's in the record. And we have a gap there, right?
Well, we have a gap. Nobody knows the specific time. I mean, I guess there was a log-in time when the call was made to 911, and Officer Shires arrived shortly after that, but we don't know the time from the accident scene to when the call was made. We don't know that.
All right. Notwithstanding the yellow light, your time is up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Justice Berger, to pick up on what you were just talking about, the admission, the non-Mirandized, the non-warned admission that she was the driver is a huge fact in this case, because the last question that I ask, I appreciate that Counsel Rapelli says that, well, it was obvious that she was the driver, she was the only one in the car. Not so. My last question to the officer was, how do you know, for example, that she was the person that was driving the car at the time of the accident? Answer, I don't know. He didn't know that. He put her in, that was why I made the probable cause argument. He essentially arrests somebody. He didn't even know whether she was the driver.
Well, but wait a second. If the fact is that she's sitting in a car with airbags deployed.
Two airbags deployed.
Yeah, on the side of the car, on the side of the road, and she's the only person there, isn't that strong circumstantial evidence that she's the driver?
It could be, but in this case I would suggest it's not, because anticipating that, I asked him those questions. I said, do you know what time the accident happened? No. Do you know whether there was anybody else in the car at the time the accident happened who perhaps has left to go get help? No. Do you know whether she was the driver? No. So it's not, sure, could it be a circumstantial case? Yes. But in this particular case, I asked enough questions, I would argue, that at least I've eliminated a lot of that. What boils down to is you've got a Harrington officer who arrests a lady, and I think this may be why the judge said it was a, whatever the word he used, improper, it wasn't illegal, I forget what he said now, arrest, is because he didn't know anything at the time he put her in custody. Now, I appreciate that his position was, well, I didn't realize I was arresting her, but we all agree that once she's not free to go, she's arrested. And there we are. Then the next thing that happens is Rendon comes down and does the non-Mirandized interrogation. One of the points I made, and I'm not sure how clear it is in the brief, but it certainly is in the record, they knew immediately that this was not a Title 21 violation. They knew that this was a Title 11 violation. So in anticipation of them arguing Berkman versus McCarty, you don't have to give warnings in a DUI, clearly they were looking at the fact that they had an injured lady, they'd flown her to the hospital, they knew that this lady was entitled to warnings, and the Superior Court ultimately agreed that she was entitled to warnings. It's a continuum here, and it's not a long continuum. They go from seeing where non-Miranda statements come in to quick blood draw, back to the station, and at station she gets the warnings that don't warn her that her other statements don't come in. I just want to quickly correct a couple of things that again, I appreciate appellate counsel wasn't at the trial and may not recognize. This was not a situation where the state found out about this tape at the last second. The trooper testified, it's a question I asked him on voir dire right before he puts the tape in. How long ago did you tell the state that you had this tape? Answer, a couple of weeks ago. So the fact that this particular prosecutor bothered to focus on it at 3 o'clock the day before doesn't cure the problem that they knew about it all along. This isn't like, gee, this just fell on me and now I'm telling you about it right away. She knew about it, according to her own witness, for a couple of weeks and didn't do anything about it. And in response to the why don't you look at the tape and let's go try the case, that's not appropriate. I'm supposed to be doing the best job I can to represent this lady. And to say, now you can watch a 20-minute videotape, because that's about how long it was, 15, 20 minutes, and then let's go in and try the case is not appropriate. If I'd had that tape ahead of time, it may have impacted whether we talked about a plea in the case. I've got a lady now suddenly saying things I didn't know she said, and maybe that makes a difference in how the whole case gets handled. What he suggested was, let's go look at it right before the trial and then we go ahead and try the case. That's not adequate preparation in a case of any kind, and certainly not a case of this magnitude. I appreciate we're talking a lot about Miranda, but I still think we've got a bad arrest, and certainly there's a clear violation of the discovery rules. And although and the sanction was on me, you can have a continuance. That actually means something. Because the way these things work is you generally get one continuance aside. So if I had a real reason that I needed a continuance on some other day, I've already used my continuance up. It wasn't even the state's got to take a continuance. It was I could have a continuance. And I suggest that that's a sanction to me who did, quite frankly, nothing wrong. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for the arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement and stand in recess.